No, I cannot be bidden. I cannot be forced. I will only do that which I know to be right. Susan crept along behind the shelves of Lifetimers. No one noticed her. When you are watching death fight, you don't notice shadows in the background. They'd never told her about this. Parents never do. Your father could be Death's apprentice and your mother Death's adopted daughter, but that's just fine detail when they become parents. Parents were never young. They were merely waiting to become parents. Susan reached the end of the shelves. Death was standing over her father. She corrected herself, the boy who would be her father. Three red marks burned on his cheek where Death had struck him. Susan raised a hand to the pale marks on her own face. But that's not how heredity works, at least the normal kind. Her mother, the girl who would become her mother, was pressed against a pillar. She had actually improved with age, Susan thought. Her dress sense certainly had. And she mentally shook herself. Fashion comments, now. Death stood over Mort, sword in one hand and Mort's own Lifetimer in the other.
You don't know how sorry this makes me, he said.
I might, said Mort. Death looked up and looked straight at Susan. His eye sockets flared blue for a moment. Susan tried to press herself into the shadows. He looked back down at Mort for a moment, and then at Isabel, and then back at Susan, and then back down at Mort, and laughed, and turned the hourglass over and snapped his fingers. Mort vanished with a small pop of imploding air. So did Isabel and the others. It was suddenly very quiet. Death put the hourglass down very carefully on the table and looked at the ceiling for a while and then said,
Albert?
Albert appeared from behind a pillar.
Would you be so good as to make me a cup of tea, please?
Yes, master. You sorted him out right enough.
Thank you.
Albert scurried off in the direction of the kitchen. Once again, there was the closest thing there could ever be to silence in the room of Lifetimers.
You'd better come out.
Susan did so, and stood before the ultimate reality. Death was 7 feet tall. He looked taller. Susan had vague memories of a figure carrying her on its shoulders through the huge dark rooms, but in memory it had been a human figure. Bony, but human in a way that she was certain of, but couldn't quite define. This wasn't human. It was tall and haughty and terrible. He might unbend enough to bend the rules, Susan thought, but that doesn't make him human. This is the keeper of the gate of the world, immortal by definition, the end of everything. He is my grandfather. Will be, anyway. Is, was. But there was the thing in the apple tree. Her mind kept swinging back to that. You looked up at the figure and thought about the tree. It was almost impossible to keep both images in one mind.
Well, well, well. You have a lot of your mother about you, said Death. And your father.
How did you know who I am? Said Susan.
I have a unique memory.
How can you remember me? I haven't even been conceived yet.
I did say unique. Your name is...
Susan, but...
Susan? Said Death bitterly. They really wanted to make sure, didn't they?
He sat down in his chair, steepled his fingers, and looked at Susan over the top of them. She looked back, matching stare for stare.
Tell me, said Death after a while, was I, will I be, am I a good grandfather?
Susan bit her lip thoughtfully.
If I tell you, won't that be a paradox?
Not for us.
Well, you've got bony knees.
Death stared at her.
Bony knees?
Sorry.
You came here to tell me that?
You've gone missing, back there. I'm having to do the duty. Albert is very worried. I came here to find things out. I didn't know my father worked for you.
He was very bad at it.
What have you done with him?
They're safe for now. I'm glad it's over. Having people around was beginning to affect my judgment. Ah, Albert.
Albert had appeared on the edge of the carpet, bearing a tea tray.
Another cup, if you would be so good.
Albert looked around and totally failed to see Susan. If you could be invisible to Miss Butts, everyone else was easy.
If you say so, master.
So, said Death, when Albert had shuffled away, I have gone missing,
and you believe you have inherited the family business. You!
I didn't want to. The horse and the rat just turned up.
Rat?
I think that's something that's going to happen.
Oh, yes, I remember. Hmm. A human doing my job. Technically possible, of course. But why?
I think Albert knows something, but he changes the subject. Albert reappeared, carrying another cup and saucer. He plonked it down pointedly on Death's desk, with the air of one who is being put upon.
"That'll be all, will it, Master?" he said.
"Thank you, Albert, yes."
Albert left again, more slowly than normal. He kept looking over his shoulder. "He doesn't change, does he?" said Susan. "Of course, that's the point about this place."
"What do you think about cats?"
"Sorry?"
"Cats. Do you like 'em?"
"They're, Susan hesitated. "All right, but a cat's just a cat."
"Chocolate," said Death. "Do you like chocolate?"
"I think it's possible to have too much," said Susan.
"You certainly don't take after Isabel."
Susan nodded. Her mother's favourite dish had been genocide by chocolate.
"And your memory? You have a good memory?"
"Oh, yes, I remember things. About how to be Death. About how it's all supposed to work. Look, just then you said you remembered about the rat, and it hasn't even happened."
Death stood up and strode across to the model of the Discworld. "Morphic resonance," he said, not looking at Susan. "Damn. People don't begin to understand it. Soul harmonics. It's responsible for so many things."
Susan pulled out Imp's lifetimer. Blue smoke was still pouring through the pinch. "Can you help me with this?" she said.
Death spun round. "I should never have adopted your mother."
"Why did you?"
Death shrugged. "What's that you've got there?"
He took Buddy's lifetime from her and held it up.
"Ah, interesting.
Do you know what it means, Grandad?"
"I've not come across it before, but I suppose it's possible, in certain circumstances. It means, somehow, that he has rhythm in his soul." "Grandad?"
"Oh, no, that can't be right. That's just a figure of speech. And what's wrong with Grandad?"
"Grandfather I can live with. Grandad, one step away from Gramps, in my opinion. Anyway, I thought you believed in logic. Calling something a figure of speech doesn't mean it's not true."
Death waved the hourglass vaguely.
"For example," he said, "many things are better than a poke in the eye with a blunt stick." "I've never understood the phrase. Surely, a sharp stick would be even worse." Death stopped. "I'm doing it again. Why should I care what the wretched phrase means, or what you call me? Unimportant. Getting entangled with humans clouds the thinking. Take it from me. Don't get involved."
"But I am human."
"I didn't say it was going to be easy, did I? Don't think about it. Don't feel."
"You're an expert, are you?" said Susan hotly.
"I may have allowed myself some flicker of emotion in the recent past," said Death, "but I can give it up any time I like."
He held up the hourglass again.
"It's an interesting fact that music, being of its nature immortal, can sometimes prolong the life of those intimately associated with it," he said. "I've noticed that famous composers in particular hang on for a long time. Death as posts most of them when I come calling. I expect some god somewhere finds that very amusing."
Death contrived to look disdainful.
"It's their kind of joke. And, of course, one that misfires. Deafness doesn't prevent composers hearing the music. It prevents them hearing the distractions."
He set the glass down and twanged it with a bony digit. It went whum.
"He has no life. He has music."
"Music's taken him over?"
"You could put it like that."
"Making his life longer?"
"Life is extensible. It happens occasionally among humans. Not often. Usually tragically, in a theatrical kind of way. But this isn't another human. This is music.
He played something on some sort of stringed instrument, like a guitar.
Death turned.
Indeed? Well, well, well.
Is that important?
It is interesting.
Is it something I should know?
It is nothing important. A piece of mythological debris. Matters will resolve themselves. You may depend upon it.
What do you mean, resolve themselves?
He will probably be dead in a matter of days.
Susan stared at the lifetimer.
But that's dreadful.
Are you romantically involved with the young man?
What? No. I've only ever seen him once.
Your eyes didn't meet across a crowded room or anything of that nature?
No, of course not.
Why should you care, then?
Because he's a human being, that's why, said Susan, surprised at herself. I don't see why people should be messed around like that, she added lamely. That's all. Oh, I don't know.
He leaned down again until his skull was on a level with her face.
But most people are rather stupid and waste their lives. Have you not seen that? Have you not looked down from the horse at a city and thought how much it resembled an ant heap, full of blind creatures who think their mundane little world is real? You see the lighted windows, and what you want to think is that there may be many interesting stories behind them, but what you know is that really there are just dull, dull souls, mere consumers of food who think their instincts are emotions and their tiny lives of more account than a whisper of wind.
The blue glow was bottomless. It seemed to be sucking her own thoughts out of her mind.
No, whispered Susan, no, I've never thought like that.
Death stood up abruptly and turned away.
You may find that it helps, he said.
But it's all just chaos, said Susan. There's no sense to the way people die. There's no justice.
Ah!
You take a hand, she persisted. You just saved my father.
I was foolish. To change the fate of one individual is to change the world. I remember that. So should you.
Death still hadn't turned to face her.
I don't see why we shouldn't change things if it makes the world better, said Susan.
Ha!
Are you too scared to change the world?
Death turned. The very sight of his expression made Susan back away. He advanced slowly towards her. His voice, when it came, was a hiss.
You say that to me? You stand there in your pretty dress and say that to me? You prattle on about changing the world?
Could you find the courage to accept it? To know what must be done and do it, whatever the cost? Is there one human anywhere in the world who knows what duty means?
His hands opened and shut convulsively.
I said you must remember. For us, time is only a place. It all spread out. There is what is and what will be. If you change that, you carry the responsibility for the change, and that is too heavy to bear.
That's just an excuse.
Susan glared at the tall figure. Then she turned and marched out of the room.
Susan?
She stopped halfway across the floor, but didn't turn round.
Yes?
Really, bony knees?
Yes.
It was probably the first piano case that had ever been made, and made out of a carpet at that. Cliff swung it easily onto his shoulder and picked up his sack of rocks in the other hand.
Is it heavy? Said Buddy.
Cliff held the piano up on one hand and weighed it reflectively.
A bit,
he said. The floorboards creaked underneath him.
Do you think we should have took all the bits out?
It's bound to work, said Glod. It's like a coach. The more bits you take off, the faster it goes. Come on.
They set out. Buddy tried to look as inconspicuous as a human can look if he is accompanying a dwarf with a big horn, an ape, and a troll carrying a piano in a bag.
I'd like a coach, said Cliff, as they headed for the drum. Big black coach, with all that liver on it.
Liver? Said Buddy.
He was beginning to get accustomed to the name.
Shields and that.
Oh, livery.
Eh?
And that.
What did you get if you had a pile of gold, Glod?
Said Buddy. In its bag, the guitar twanged gently to the sound of his voice. Glod hesitated. He wanted to say that for a dwarf, the whole point of having a pile of gold was, well, to have a pile of gold.
It didn't have to do anything other than just be as auracious as gold could be.
"Dunno," he said. "Never thought I'd have a pile of gold. What about you?"
"I swore I'd be the most famous musician in the world."
"That's dangerous, that kind of swear," said Cliff.
"Ook, ook."
"Isn't it what every artist wants?" said Buddy.
"In my experience," said Glod, "what every true artist wants, really wants, is to be paid."
"And famous," said Buddy.
"Famous I don't know about," said Glod. "It's hard to be famous and alive. I just want to play music every day and hear someone say, 'Thanks, that was great. Here is some money. Same time tomorrow, okay?'"
"Is that all?"
"It's a lot. I'd like the people to say, 'We need a good horn man. Get Glod Glodson.'"
Sounds a bit dull," said Buddy.
"I like dull. It lasts."
They reached the side door of the Drum and entered a gloomy room that smelled of rats and second-hand beer. There was a distant murmur of voices from the bar.
"Sounds like there's a lot of people in," said Glod.
Hibiscus bustled up.
"You boys ready, then?" he said.
"Hold on a minute," said Cliff. "We ain't discussed our pay."
"I said $6, said Hibiscus. "What do you expect? You aren't guild, and the guild rate is $8.
"We wouldn't ask you for $8, said Glod.
"Right. We'll take 16. 16? You can't do that. That's almost twice guild rate."
"But there's a lot of people out there," said Glod. "I bet you're renting a lot of beer."
"We don't mind going home."
"Let's talk about this," said Hibiscus.
He put his arm around Glod's head and led him to a corner of the room. Buddy watched the librarian examine the piano. He'd never seen a musician begin by trying to eat his instrument. Then the ape lifted the lid and regarded the keyboard. He tried a few notes, apparently for taste. Glod returned, rubbing his hands.
"That sorted him out," he said.
"Ha! How much?" said Cliff.
$6, said Glod.
There was some silence.
Sorry, said Buddy. "We were waiting for the teen."
"I had to be firm," said Glod. "He got down to $2 at one point."
Some religions say that the universe was started with a word, a song, a dance, a piece of music. The listening monks of the Ramtops have trained their hearing until they can tell the value of a playing card by listening to it, and have made it their task to listen intently to the subtle sounds of the universe to piece together, from the fossil echoes, the very first sounds. There was certainly, they say, a very strange noise at the beginning of everything. But the keenest ears, the ones who win most at poker, who listen to the frozen echoes in ammonite and amber, swear they can detect some tiny sounds before that. It sounded, they say, like someone counting. 1, 2, 3, 4. The very best one, who listened to basalt, said he thought he could make out very faintly some numbers that came even earlier. When they asked him what it was, he said, "It sounds like 1, 2. No one ever asked what, if there was a sound that called the universe into being, happened to it afterwards. It's mythology. You're not supposed to ask that kind of question. On the other hand, Ridcully believed that everything had come into being by chance, or in the particular case of the Dean, out of spite. Senior wizards didn't usually drink in the Mended Drum, except when they were off duty. They were aware that they were here tonight in some sort of ill-defined official capacity, and were seated rather primly in front of their drinks. There was a ring of empty seats around them, but it was not very big because the Drum was unusually crowded.
Lot of ambience in here," said Ridcully, looking around. "Ah, I see they do real ale again. I'll have a pint of Turbot's Really Odd, please."
The wizards watched him as he drained the mug. Ankh-Morpork pork beer has a flavour all its own. It's something to do with the water. Some people say it's like consommé, but they're wrong. Consommé is cooler. Ridcully smacked his lips happily.
"Ah, we certainly know what goes into good beer in Ankh-Morpork," pork, he said.
The wizards nodded. They certainly did. That's why they were drinking gin and tonic. Ridcully looked around. Normally at this time of night there was a fight going on somewhere, or at least a mild stabbing. But there was just a buzz of conversation, and everyone was watching the small stage at the far end of the room, where nothing was happening in large amounts. There was theoretically a curtain across it. It was only an old sheet, and there was a succession of thuds and thumps from behind it. The wizards were quite close to the stage. Wizards tend to get good seats. Ridcully thought he could make out some whispering and see shadows moving behind the sheet.
He said, what do we call ourselves?
Cliff, Buddy, Glod and the Librarian. I thought he knew that.
No, we've got to have one name for all of us.
Oh, are they rationed then?
Something like the Merry Troubadours, maybe.
Ooh. Glod and the Glodettes?
Oh, yes. How about Cliff and the Cliffettes?
Ook, 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 ook.
No, we need a different type of name, like the music.
How about Gold? Good dwarf name.
No, something different from that. Silver, then.
Ook.
I don't think we should name ourselves after any kind of heavy metal, Glod.
What's so special? We're a band of people who play music.
Names are important.
The guitar is special. How about the band with Buddy's guitar in it?
Ooh. Something shorter.
The universe held its breath.
The band with rocks in.
I like it. Short and slightly dirty, just like me.
Ooh. We ought to think up a name for the music, too.
It's bound to occur to us sooner or later.
Rid Cully looked around the bar. On the opposite side of the room was Cut-Me-Own-Throat Dibbler, Ankh-Morpork's most spectacularly unsuccessful businessman. He was trying to sell someone a felonious hot dog, a sign that some recent surefire business venture had collapsed. Dibbler sold his hot sausages only when all else failed. It wasn't the taste. Plenty of hot dogs taste bad. But Dibbler had now actually managed to produce sausages that didn't taste of anything. It was weird. No matter how much mustard, ketchup and pickle people put on them, they still didn't taste of anything. Not even the midnight dogs they sell to drunks in Helsinki can quite manage that. He gave Rid Cully a wave at no charge. The next table was occupied by Satchel Mouth Lemon, one of the Musicians Guild recruiting officers, with a couple of associates whose apparent knowledge of music extended only to the amount of percussion available on the human skull. His determined expression suggested that he was not there for his health, although the fact that the guild officers had a mean look about them rather hinted that he was there for other people's health, mostly in order to take it away. Rid Cully brightened up. The evening might just possibly be more interesting than he'd expected. There was another table near the stage. He nearly didn't notice it, and then his gaze swiveled back to it of its own accord. There was a young woman sitting there all by herself. Of course, it wasn't unusual to see young women in the drum, even unaccompanied young women. They were generally there in order to become accompanied. The odd thing was that although people were jammed along the benches, she had space all round her. She was quite attractive in a skinny way, Rid Cully thought. What was the tomboy word? Gammon or something. She was wearing a black lace dress of the sort worn by healthy young women who want to look consumptive, and had a raven sitting on her shoulder. She turned her head, saw Rid Cully looking at her, and vanished. More or less. He was a wizard, after all. He felt his eyes watering as she flickered in and out of vision. Ah, well, he'd heard the Tooth Fairy girls were in the city these days. It'd be one of the night people. They probably had a day off, just like everyone else. A movement on the table made him look down. The Death of Rats skittered past, carrying a bowl of peanuts. He turned back to the wizards. The Dean was still wearing his pointy hat. There was also something slightly shiny about his face.
You look hot, Dean, said Rid Cully.
Oh, I'm lovely and cool, Arch-Chancellor, I assure you, said the Dean. Something runny oozed past his nose. The lecturer in recent runes sniffed suspiciously.
Is someone cooking bacon, he said.
Take it off, Dean, said Rid Cully. You'll feel a lot better. Smells more like Mrs. Palm's House of Negotiable Affection to me, said the senior wrangler. They looked at him in surprise. I just happened to walk past once.
Runes, please take the Dean's hat off for him, will you? Said Rid Cully.
I assure you, the hat came off. Something long and greasy, and very nearly the same pointy shape, flopped forward.
Dean, said Rid Cully, eventually, what have you done to your hair? It looks like a spike at the front, and a duck's ass, excuse my clatching, at the back. And it's all shiny.
Lord, that'd be the bacon smell, said the lecturer.
That's true, said Rid Cully. But what about the floral smell?
Mumble, 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 lavender, mumble, 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 said the Dean sullenly.
Pardon, Dean?
I said it's because I added lavender oil, said the Dean loudly, and some of us happen to think it's a nifty hairstyle, thank you so very much. Your trouble, Arch-Chancellor, is that you don't understand people of our age.
What?
You mean 7 months older than me? Said Ridcully.
This time the Dean hesitated.
What did I just say? He said. Have you been taking dried frog pills, old chap? Said Ridcully.
Of course not. They're for the mentally unstable, said the Dean.
Ah, there's the trouble then.
The curtain went up, or rather was jerkily pulled aside. The band with Roxin blinked in the torchlight. No one clapped. On the other hand, no one threw anything either. By drum standards, this was a hearty welcome. Ridcully saw a tall, curly-headed young man clutching what looked like an undernourished guitar, or possibly a banjo that had been used in a fight. Beside him was a dwarf holding a battle horn. At the rear was a troll, hammer in each paw, seated behind a pile of rocks. And to one side was the librarian, standing in front of... Ridcully leaned forward. What appeared to be the skeleton of a piano, balanced on some beer kegs. The boy looked paralysed by the attention. He said,
"Hello, Ankh-Morpork."
And this amount of conversation apparently having exhausted him, he started to play. It was a simple little rhythm, one that you might easily have ignored if you'd met it in the street. It was followed by a sequence of crashing chords, and then Ridcully realised... It hadn't been followed by the chords because the rhythm was there all the time, which was impossible. No guitar could be played like that. The dwarf blew a sequence of notes on the horn. The troll picked up the beat. The librarian brought both hands down upon the piano keyboard, apparently at random. Ridcully had never heard such a din. And then, it wasn't a din anymore. It was like that nonsense about white light that the young wizards in the High Energy Magic Building went on about. They said that all the colours together made up white, which was bloody nonsense as far as Ridcully was concerned, because everyone knew that if you mixed up all the colours you could get your hands on, you got a sort of greeny-brown mess, which certainly wasn't any kind of white. But now he had a vague idea what they meant. All this noise, this mess of music, suddenly came together, and there was a new music inside it. The Dean's quiff was quivering. The whole crowd was moving. Ridcully realised his foot was tapping. He stamped on it with his other foot. Then he watched the troll carry the beat and hammer the rocks until the walls shook. The librarian's fingers swooped along the keyboard. Then his toes did the same. And all the time the guitar hooted and screamed and sang out the melody. The wizards were bouncing in their seats and twirling their fingers in the air. Ridcully leaned over to the bursar and screamed at him.
"What?" shouted the bursar. "I said they've all gone mad except me and you."
"What?
It's the music."
"Yes, it's great," said the bursar, waving his skinny hands in the air.
"And I'm not too certain about you."
Ridcully sat down again and pulled out the thermometer. It was vibrating crazily, which was no help at all. It didn't seem to be able to decide if this was magic or not. He nudged the bursar sharply.
"This ain't magic. This is something else."
"Yeah, you're exactly right."
Ridcully had the feeling that he suddenly wasn't speaking the right language.
"I mean, it's too much."
"Yes,"
Ridcully sighed.
"Is it time for your dried frog pill?"
Smoke was coming out of the stricken piano. The librarian's hands were walking through the keys like Casanunda in a nunnery. Ridcully looked around. He felt all alone. Someone else hadn't been overcome by the music. Satchelmouth had stood up. So had his two associates. They had drawn some knobbly clubs. Ridcully knew the guild laws. Of course, they had to be enforced. You couldn't run a city without them. This certainly wasn't licensed music. If there ever was unlicensed music, this was it. Nevertheless, he rolled up his sleeve and prepared for a quick fireball just in case. One of the men dropped his club and clutched his foot. The other one spun around as if something had slapped his ear. Satchelmouth's hat dented, as if someone had just hit him on the head. Ridcully, one eye watering terribly, thought he made out the Tooth Fairy girl bringing the handle of a scythe down on Satchelmouth's head. The Arch-Chancellor was quite a bright man, but often had trouble in forcing his train of thought to change tracks. He was having difficulty with the idea of a scythe. After all, grass didn't have teeth. And then the fireball burned his fingers, and then, as he sucked frantically at them, He realized that there was something in the sound, something extra.
"Oh, no,"
he said, as the fireball floated to the floor and set fire to the bursar's boot.
"It's alive."
He grabbed the beer mug, finished the contents hurriedly, and rammed it upside down on the tabletop. The moon shone over the Klatchian Desert in the vicinity of the dotted line. Both sides of it got exactly the same amount of moonlight, although minds like Mr. Cleet's deplored this state of affairs. The sergeant strolled across the packed sand of the parade ground. He stopped, sat down, and produced a cheroot. Then he pulled out a match, reached down and struck it on something sticking out of the sand, which said,
"Good evening."
"I expect you've had enough, eh, soldier?"
said the sergeant.
"Enough what, sergeant?"
"2 days in the sun, no food, no water. I expect you're delirious with thirst and are just begging to be dug out, hm?"
"Yes, it is certainly very dull."
"Dull?"
"I am afraid so."
"Dull? It's not meant to be dull, it's the pit. It's meant to be a horrible physical, mental torture. After 1 day of it, you're supposed to be,
The sergeant glanced surreptitiously at some writing on his wrist.
A raving madman. I've been watching you all day. You haven't even groaned. I can't sit in my thing. You sit in it. There's papers and things in it.
Office.
Working with you outside like this. I can't bear it."
Beau Nidal glanced upwards. He felt it was time for a kindly gesture.
"Help! Help! Help! Help!" he said.
The sergeant sagged with relief.
"This assists people to forget, does it?"
"Forget? People forget everything when they're given their,
The pit."
"Yes, yes, that's it, the pit."
"Ah, do you mind if I ask a question?"
"What?"
"Do you mind if perhaps I have another day?"
The sergeant opened his mouth to reply, and the dregs attacked over the nearest sand dune.
"Music,"
said the patrician.
"Ah, tell me more."
He leaned back in an attitude that suggested attentive listening. He was extremely good at listening. He created a kind of mental suction. People told him things just to avoid the silence. Besides, Lord Vetinari, the supreme ruler of Ankh-Morpork, rather liked music. People wondered what sort of music would appeal to such a man. Highly formalized chamber music, possibly, or thunder and lightning opera scores. In fact, the kind of music he really liked was the kind that never got played. It ruined music, in his opinion, to torment it by involving it on dried skins, bits of dead cat, and lumps of metal hammered into wires and tubes. It ought to stay written down on the page in rows of little dots and crotchets, all neatly caught between lines. Only there was it pure. It was when people started doing things with it that the rot set in. Much better to sit quietly in a room and read the sheets, with nothing between yourself and the mind of the composer but a scribble of ink. Having it played by sweaty fat men and people with hair in their ears and spit dribbling out of the end of their oboe, well, the idea made him shudder. Although not much, because he never did anything to extremes. So,
"And then what happened?" he said.
"And then he started singing, Your Honour," said Cumbling Michael, licensed beggar and informal informant. "A song about great fiery balls."
The patrician raised an eyebrow.
"And pardon?" "Something like that. Couldn't really make out the words. The reason being, the piano exploded."
"Ah,
I imagine this interrupted the proceedings somewhat."
"Nah, the monkey went on playing what was left," said Cumbling Michael. "And people got up and started cheering and dancing and stamping their feet like there was a plague of cockroaches."
"And you say the men from the Musicians' Guild were hurt?"
"It were dead strange. They were white as a sheet afterwards. At least,"
Cumbling Michael thought about the state of his own bedding,
"white as some sheets."
The patrician glanced at his reports while the beggar talked. It had certainly been a strange evening. A riot at the Drum, well, that was normal, although it didn't sound exactly like a typical riot, and he'd never heard of wizards dancing. He rather felt he recognised the signs. There was only one thing that could make it worse.
Tell me, he said, what was Mr. Dibbler's reaction to all this?
What, Your Honour?
A simple enough question, I should have thought.
Cumbling Michael found the words,
but how did you know old Dibbler was there? I never said,
arranging themselves for the attention of his larynx, and then had second, third, and fourth thoughts about saying them.
He just sat and stared, Your Honour, with his mouth open, and then he rushed right out. I see. Oh, dear. Thank you, Cumbling Michael. Feel free to leave.
The beggar hesitated.
Foul old Ron said as Your Honour sometimes pays for information, he said. Did he? Really? He said that, did he? Well, that is interesting.
Veterinari scribbled a note in the margin of a report.
Thank you. Don't let me detain you. God's bless Your Honour,
said Cumbling Michael, and ran for it. When the sound of the beggar's boots had died away, the patrician strolled over to the window, stood with his hands clasped behind his back, and sighed. There were probably city-states, he reasoned, where the rulers only had to worry about the little things. Barbarian invasions, the balance of payments, assassination, the local volcano erupting. There weren't people busily opening the door of reality and metaphorically saying, "Hi, come on in, pleased to see you, what a nice axe you have there. Incidentally, can I make some money out of you since you're here?" Sometimes Lord Veterinari wondered what had happened to Mr. Hong. Everyone knew, of course, in general terms, but not exactly what. What a city. In the spring, the river caught fire. About once a month, the Alchemist's Guild exploded. He walked back to his desk and made another brief note. He was rather afraid that he was going to have someone killed. Then he picked up the third movement of Fondel's Prelude in G Major and settled back to read.